all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossum.
And welcome this Sunday afternoon to Veterans Radio. This is Jim Fossone. We're glad to have you on this day here after the in between the holidays, I suppose, is the best way to look at it. We've got an exciting program for you. We're going to talk to author Lisa Lark on her new book, There and Back, The Vietnam War Through the Eyes of Those Who Lived It. And in the second half of the hour, we're going to talk to John Lee Dumas, who's a Iraq veteran, and now runs Entrepreneur on Fire, a daily webcast for those who need to be fired up. So he's quite an exciting guest, big national figure. We're glad to have him. So before we get started this afternoon, we're going to talk about a couple of other things. Initially, I'd like to let you know Bob Gould will be talking to Dr. Rebecca Grant, who is the president of IRIS Independent Research out of Washington, D.C. next weekend. So make sure you tune back in. Dr. Grant has been on the show a number of times. She is one of those big thinkers, always thinking about sort of what's out over the horizon for the United States, its military, its force design and shape, certainly its Air Force and aviation capabilities. So Bob will have an exciting discussion then with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Tune in next week. Did want to mention a press release that we saw this week from the VA, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, as a result of the Veterans Access Choice and Accountability Act of 2014, is expanding its eligibility for veterans in need of mental health care due to sexual assault or sexual harassment that occurred during their military service. Now, this is important because at Legal Help for Veterans, we see a lot of problems with soldiers who have suffered from MST, military sexual trauma. And this new act also makes sure it applies to reservists and National Guard members, even if you've just been participating in weekend drill. And veterans do not need to have a service-connected disability or even be seeking disability compensation to be eligible for MST-related counseling and care. So if they've told you no in the past, go back to the VA. They have a new program in place, and that may help a lot of people. You've heard us talk a little bit on Veterans Radio about our book that we have out here at the holiday time, Best of Veterans Radio Vietnam Stories. We took some of our great stories from the past, put it into a nice, very readable book that we think you'll enjoy. If you're a contributor to Veterans Radio by supporting us, by going to our website and making a contribution of $25 or more, we'll send you the Vietnam Story book that just got published, and I think you'll really enjoy that for supporting Veterans Radio. And in that same vein, I'd encourage all of you to go visit our media partner, Rally Point. Rally Point is a military and veteran online community. I think you'll find that a great way to connect with your former military members, unit members, and current veterans. So that's another great resource for you that's out there. We're going to go to a short break, and after that, we'll come back with our first guest, author Lisa Lark.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for 5 decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. Our first guest this afternoon is Lisa Lark. Lisa, say hello to the Veterans Radio audience.
Hello, everyone. How are you tonight, Jim?
We're great. We're glad to have you on. It's I've really been looking forward to talking to you about your current book, There and Back, The Vietnam War Through the Eyes of Those Who Lived It. Lisa, this is hot off the press, isn't it?
Yes, it's been about 3 weeks now, I think, since we have it shipping out to customers. But it's been about 2.5 years in the making, I would say.
Well, that's where we wanted to start, is go back 2.5 years. What was the original motivation for this, and what was your original interest in putting it together?
Well, this book kind of came out of my first book, All They Left Behind, which was the book for the 30th anniversary of the wall in Washington, D.C. And once we finished that project, I had so many amazing photographs, and so many Vietnam vets and their families were willing to share their stories and their letters and their photographs with me. There was so much more material that people needed to see, and this book kind of came directly out of that material that I had.
Well, let's back up then to 2012, All They Left Behind,
mm-hmm.
Legacies of the Men and Women on the Wall, published by MT Publishing Company of Evansville, Indiana. Tell us about the motivation for putting All They Left Behind together.
Well, that came from the desire of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund to get a photo for every name that was on the wall. That's their ongoing Wall of Faces campaign. And I started working with them in about 2011 to begin locating the photos for the men from Dearborn, Michigan, which is my hometown where I grew up and where I was a longtime high school teacher. And from that, we started working on Michigan, and then we started working on a more national level, and the stories that told the lives of these men and women just desperately need to be told, because 50 years from now, 100 years from now, when the people who knew these men and women, these names on the wall, when they're gone, the stories still need to be told. People need to know that this is just more than names on a wall.
And Lisa, I think you and I bumped into each other probably while you were still looking for some of the photos for the first book, All They Left Behind. Talk a little bit about the process of trying to find the photos you needed and the stories you needed to tell those individual stories of men and women who had died during that war.
Well, for the book itself, for All They Left Behind, one thing that was critically important to us was we paint as broad a picture as we could. We wanted to stay away from it was just officers, or it was just enlistees, or it was just draftees, and it was just this or just that. We really wanted to make sure we captured a little bit of everyone who fought and died in this war. And so we started out looking to make sure that we hit all five branches of service, because in a lot of the materials, the Coast Guard is just completely overlooked. In a lot of the materials, you don't get the first-person recollections from family members and from veterans. And as I had been a teacher, I know that's what students of this next generation remember. They remember the first-person stories. They remember the photographs. They remember the faces that look like them. And so it was critical that we find as many different types of people from as many different types of places as we could. You know, and in All They Left Behind, we had photographs of men who had been in Vietnam for less than a day, and we had men who won the Medal of Honor. So we really tried to cover everything that we could possibly get.
Lisa, you've mentioned that you were a high school teacher. You have a bachelor's and a master's in education, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
From the University of Michigan, Dearborn. What brought you to the project to begin with? The military family, a lost member of the family? How did this become your passion?
Well, my father is a Vietnam-era Marine. He was in the United States Marine Corps from 1966 to 1969. So my younger brother and I were always raised to respect the military, to honor the military. We were very active in the city of Dearborn's Memorial Day parade. My dad's been driving the Grand Marshal since I was probably 14 years old. And when I started teaching high school, I was teaching at Edsel Ford High School, which is where I was a student, ironically. And Edsel Ford has a wonderful Memorial Day ceremony where they read the names of the 23 men from Edsel Ford who died. And after that ceremony, one of my students started asking me some questions about a young man. He had recognized the name. Dearborn is still a relatively small town, and there was a current high school student with that name. And he wanted to know a little bit more, and I had no answers. And as a teacher, anytime your student is inquisitive about absolutely anything, you help them find the answers. And so it sort of grew from that.
And in fact, part of what's in All They Left Behind is an essay that I believe you wrote regarding the, I think there were 57 men from Dearborn who lost their life in Vietnam.
Yes. And that doesn't include non-in-country casualties, so lives that were lost in training or an accident. That brings the total up to 69.
And that would have been a pretty significant number of deaths arising out of the city of Dearborn during that war, wouldn't it have been?
Yes, it was absolutely all-encompassing for the city. And it was just an interesting perspective because, you know, teaching high school at the time, these were my boys. They were that age. They were walking right out of Edsel or Dearborn or Fortson in June or January, and in many cases, walking right into the military. And being, you know, losing their lives within a year, within 2 years. And it was just very tragic, and it really brought it home, I think, for myself and my students in a way that none of us expected.
Well, certainly what you've written has become, at least I would think it's become, a very good teaching tool for families to pass on to children, for educators to use with their classrooms. Was that a little bit of what you were trying to accomplish?
I guess in a sense, because that's my background, that came out a lot more than I intended it to. Because as I said, when you have a student who has no point of reference for Vietnam, and as I said myself, it's my father and his generation that fought this war and that waited on the home front for it. And one of the young men featured in All They Left Behind, Lance Corporal Charles Meek, was a classmate of my mom's from grade school all the way through high school. Those first-person generational, you're going to have those gaps. You know, in my generation, I was born right before we left Vietnam in 1975. And as my children and my grandchildren get older, these are the stories that are going to resonate. You know, not necessarily in a textbook where you see one paragraph about Tet or about the fall of Saigon. That's not going to resonate as much as a photograph would or as a letter from someone who was there.
When you turned to the material that you had developed and started thinking about putting There and Back together, what were you trying to accomplish differently in your second book as compared to your first?
Well, in There and Back, one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish is to give these men and women who were there and who did wait on the home front and who did sit in front of their TVs to wait for the draft lottery numbers, I wanted those stories to come out. And one of the things you'll notice about the difference between the two books is that All They Left Behind is very text-heavy. Those are my words, my writing, and just a few photos here and there. There and Back is far more photo-based and far less text, I should say, that I wrote myself. It's very quote-heavy. The words come from the men and women who were there. The photos were all donated to me and allowed me to use them by veterans and veterans' families. And they wrote most of the captions, and they all filled out surveys for me and explained what was happening in the photos. And so the majority of the words are theirs. And that's really what I wanted to bring to light.
One of the things I've just got to pass along to the listeners is that this book, your second book, There and Back, the Vietnam War Through the Eyes of Those Who Lived It, is a beautifully published book. The photos, whether they be in black and white or in color, are great. Everyone makes you want to stop and read the caption and talk about either, you know, a particular guy or a particular thing that they're doing. You really did a great job of getting a wide selection of photos that when I was going through this, I thought, these are their personal photos nobody's ever seen before.
Absolutely. And that was my goal. And I had a lot of people send me cruise books from men and women in the Navy. I had a lot of people send me newspapers, you know, the Army papers and stuff that would be distributed. And I said, thank you very much, but that's not what I want. I don't want professional photos. I want what you took with your camera and sent home to your families. And a lot of these, just like you said, not only have they never been seen by the public, some of these had never been seen by their own families. Because, and this is one of the sadder things for me, is that a lot of these veterans felt like no one would want to see them. Why is that interesting to anyone? This is just what I did. It's just my life. And for someone that's a generation removed like myself, this is fascinating. This is a level of the war that I have never, ever seen. And I'm just, you know, upset that I couldn't use every photo that I had.
Folks, I would tell you to pick up this book if you've got a grandfather or father or uncle who was in Vietnam, or you want to educate your children about what that was like, because you'll go through this, and at every photo there'll be something to look at, and you'll end up leaving it going, well, I didn't know that. And there's humor in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
There is a picture on page 48 where somebody painted on a 500-pound bomb. It's not the gift. It's the thought behind it. So I suspect that you received a fair number of those kind of photos where you found humor in places you might not think it would be.
Well, by far the best part for me has been meeting these men and women and talking to them and hearing their stories, because, you know, they'll start to talk to me and they'll say, oh, well, you know, you're a historian, you're a professor, you probably don't care about that. And I have to stop them in their tracks and say, no, that's what I want. There's plenty of books written by generals, written by political scientists, written by, you know, higher-ups, historians, academics, and things like that. Not that those aren't great books, but I want to talk to you. You know, you are the ones who were there, who were, you know, sleeping on wet ground for 6 months, and something that might be an afterthought to you is something that's going to absolutely, you know, blow people's minds and just look at it and go, like you said, I didn't know that people did that. I didn't know, you know, and even the simple things like how they showered, you know, and using that term very, very loosely because it's probably just a bucket of rain, but, you know, how do they keep clean? Where did the food come from when you're in the field for that long? And those were things that, having been a teacher and having not been alive during the war, I could look at it and I'd have conversations with my students. Like, if you could ask someone who was in Vietnam the most random question you could think of, what would you ask them? And then that's what guided me a lot of the way, is that, you know, the battles have been described by outsiders or by higher-ups so many times. I wanted to see what it was like from just, you know, regular Johnny from St. Louis or from Los Angeles or from Austin.
Absolutely. You didn't approach this as, I'm going to tell the story of the Vietnam War.
Absolutely not.
I have no interest in telling
any political information about it at all. And one of the things that people will notice when they read either one of my books, I don't talk about winning and losing, about right or wrong, about who did this and who didn't do this. This is about the men and women who were there.
So you broke this book up into three parts, which I think sort of tells the story. Maybe you can tell our listeners how those three parts are broken out.
Well, basically what I wanted to do when I started this process is tell the story from the moment that someone would enter the military, whether that be through the draft, whether that be through enlistment, officer, what have you. I wanted to tell it from that moment of entering the military from civilian life, and taking you all the way back to where you are today, and what led you to the military, what experiences you had while you were in the military, whether or not you went to Vietnam, because those are valuable experiences as well. You know, the Vietnam War was not only fought in Southeast Asia, there were millions of other people contributing as well, and I don't personally believe that their contributions should be overlooked. And so we talk about people who trained and didn't go overseas. We talk about people who maybe enlisted because they felt they had to, because of maybe a judge had told them it's this or nothing. And I broke it into getting there, being there, and coming home. I felt that those were the three most natural breaks within the story, how you got to Vietnam, what you did when you were there, and what you did when you came home, and how you dealt with your experiences. And so within that, we broke each one of those three parts up a little bit, but that was sort of the most natural break for it.
Well, I want to talk about two subparts of getting through.
Okay.
That, again, this sort of, I think, helps paint the picture. This isn't your typical book. And one would be hygiene and the other communicating with home.
Okay.
Would you talk about why you did both of those?
Well, when I started looking at the life in Vietnam aspect, you know, I had, I think, more than, I want to say something like 275 contributors, and that is everyone from people who filled out a long survey for me to people who just sent me an email in passing, like, hey, I've got this one photo. I don't want to do this survey because it seems ridiculous and why would you care? But I'm going to tell you this one photo with this one story. And so I counted everybody that gave me information as a contributor. And when I kept coming through the stories, as you said earlier, Jim, I did want to inject a little bit of humor because for these men and women, they kept coming back to that. Those were the stories that they continued to tell me, you know, about the time that someone was walking in the mud and both of their boots came off and they fell on their face, or about the time that, you know, this soldier that they had lost in combat used to always sing in the shower, and that's what they remembered. And so when I would look over these surveys, I would see these very lighter moments and these very personal moments and these very touching moments, and I knew that I had to do something with them. And once the photos started coming in, the hygiene photos were probably one of the ones that I received the most of. And as someone who has studied the war but not necessarily looked at that particular element of it, I had no idea of the strange and unusual and ingenious ways that these men and women met their needs for hygiene and, you know, shaving on the backs of pans and, you know, using gas cans as shower heads and all these different things. And for me, I think there's a lot of camaraderie in the hygiene photos that really makes them really touching.
Well, I think you do a great job capturing the sort of day-to-day life of getting through. There's a photo of a clear spring day in 1970 where laundry's drying in the sun at the 91st Evacuation Hospital.
Oh, with the sunset?
Facing the South China Sea with the sunset.
It's gorgeous.
Could be in the Chamber of Commerce magazine.
And these are photos that, as you said, have been sitting in people's on their hard drives and in their basements for 30, 40, 50 years. And
let's talk about communicating with home, because I think our Iraq and Afghanistan veterans maybe don't fully appreciate the challenges of communicating with home back during the Vietnam War, and I think your book captures that.
That one actually grew out of the main photo on the page where Stanley Herzog's mother and grandmother are sitting in front of the reel-to-reel tape player and sending messages to him. And I actually knew I had to have that photo in the book. And it's such a simple, you know, to describe it to your listeners, it's just a simple black-and-white photo of two women at a kitchen table in front of a reel-to-reel tape looking at photos. And what they would do is that when Stanley was in Vietnam, he would take a roll of photos and send it home to his parents along with a reel-to-reel of his diary of the war. And they would develop the photos and listen to his messages and then record their own message and send it back. And there's just such a sweetness to this photo that, you know, is not something that you expect to see. And as you said, for veterans in Iraq and Afghanistan, you're using Skype, you're using, instant message, you're using Instagram, you're using Facebook, and you have the ability to communicate, obviously not as much as you would like, but on a far more regular basis. And, you know, the way that we communicated with our loved ones in Vietnam or even overseas was so random, and the scheduling was so difficult. And sometimes you'd get 12 letters at once in 1 week, and then sometimes you'd get, you know, three every other day, and there was just no way to tell. And you just did the best you could with what you had, and I think that photo captures it. And along with the other favorite part of that is the C-Rat postcard.
Yes.
That's on page 75. It's just communicating by any means necessary and getting your messages out to your loved ones.
So somebody took their MRE box turkey loaf, converted it into a postcard and sent it to their probably spouse or mother, and somehow it ended up in your hands and you were able to get a photograph of it and put it in the book. It again, that's one of those ones that sort of made you smile when you turned the page and you didn't expect it.
And that's what I got, and that's kind of how I built the book, was that I had these great words and these great surveys, but I tried to build it around the photos. Is what is this story that 50 years from now somebody's going to pick up this book at, you know, the Plymouth Library or the, you know, Edsel Ford High School Library, they're going to pick it up and they're going to flip through it and they're going to see this, you know, smiling young man making his tape to send home, or, you know, a group of guys eating hot dogs.
I actually, again, want to tell our listeners that if you've got somebody in the family, maybe they haven't told their stories before, Grab a copy of this book, sit down with them, and as you go page by page, I am positive that they will open up and start telling stories about, yeah, I was there, I saw something like that, or yeah, that's how we had to deal with getting shaved or getting cleaned or getting food or communicating. And I think that's going to be the lasting value of the book, Lisa. I hope that's what you wanted.
That's absolutely what I wanted. I mean, you know, one of the things when I go to different veterans groups, and I've been very lucky to meet a couple different groups that have asked me to come and speak to them, and one of the things I talk about is that, you know, I'm trying to share these memories. I'm trying to pass along these stories so that when you're gone, your friends aren't going to be forgotten.
Lisa, we're running out of time on the first part of the hour here. We'll hit a hard break, but tell our listeners how they reach you. Maybe tell us what's next for you as well.
Well, right now I'm looking at finishing up all of the photographs for the state of Michigan. We're particularly focused on the city of Detroit. The city of Detroit does not have a lot of photos represented on the Wall of Faces, so I'm definitely eager to hear from anyone who knew someone that lost their lives in Vietnam. And you can get a hold of me if you Google my name or go to the Facebook page for There and Back, and I'll be glad to talk to any of your listeners at any time.
Well, again, we really appreciate you coming on. You did a fantastic job at both of these books. They're published by MT Publishing Company out of Evansville, Indiana. And you can find Lisa very easy by Googling her name. Lisa, thank you very much for joining us on Veterans Radio, and keep up the excellent work.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it, and I'd like to thank all your veteran listeners for their service to their country and wish you all a Happy New Year.
Great. Thank you very much.
And thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
I hope our listeners will stay with us. We're going to the news, and then we will be back for our next segment. Welcome back to Veterans Radio on WAAM 1600 Talk Radio. This is Jim Fossone, and I'm very excited to have our next guest on. John Lee Dumas is going to tell us a little bit about his travels through the military, what he learned from his service commitment, and now how he's applying it in the business world. John, say hi to the Veterans Radio listening audience.
Veterans Radio listening audience, hello, this is John, and Jim, I'm prepared to ignite.
Are you all fired up for this interview?
I am fired up, my friend.
Good, good. Well, John, you first came to my attention in the Forbes article that profiled you this summer. Great article about you, and the thing that caught my attention is, wait a minute, this guy served in the military. So that's where I want to start. Tell us a little bit about Providence College and YROTC, and sort of take it from there.
Sure. So I'm just a country boy, Jim, grew up in the state of Maine, and decided to go to college on an Army ROTC scholarship because Providence was the school of my dreams, but it cost about $50,000 a year, and I didn't want to come out of school with $50,000 in debt. Plus, I came from a family of military veterans, and I knew that was always a path that I wanted to at least check out and peruse a little bit. So,
tell us a little bit about the family connection, because I haven't read that elsewhere, but that was my guess, is that there's a family history of service to our country.
Exactly, yeah. Both grandfathers served in the World War II and Korean War, and then my father actually was in the service for over 30 years and actually was in JAG. And so I knew that that was something that I wanted to check out. So when I applied at 17 years old, you know, I was really interested in seeing what that was going to be about, and got accepted and spent 4 years training as a cadet at Providence College, the Patriot Battalion.
And what did you get your undergraduate degree in?
American Studies and Political Science was my dual major.
And that really got you ready to go to your first assignment, didn't it?
Yeah, that really prepared me to go off to that first big assignment that I had.
So tell us what the U.S. Army decided you were eminently prepared to do.
So, you know, I was actually a senior in college during 9/11, which I know all of our listeners are very familiar with, and that made me the first class of commissioned officers post 9/11. So when we graduated in 2002, we knew that sooner than later we were going to be off to serve our country, and that was the fact. In September of 2003, I was deployed with Big Red 1, the 1st Infantry Division, to Iraq for a 13-month tour of duty.
And tell us a little bit about your tour of duty in Iraq.
So I was a platoon leader, Jim, of tanks. So it's called an armored platoon leader. So 16 men in 4 tanks was what I was in charge of. And we were stationed in the westernmost sector of the Sunni Triangle. So we were out in the Aramadi, Habaniya, and Taquadum area. And it was a really intense 13 months. You know, it was during the 2003-2004 very, very difficult and bloody time to be out there. Of my 16 men that went out there, including myself as a platoon leader, sadly, only 12 of us returned. You know, we, 4 of us didn't make the ultimate sacrifice, and including my company commander. And it was not something that a 23-24-year-old was really prepared to cope with, but, you know, it was the reality of the situation, and It really made me kind of grow up quickly, so to speak.
And when you returned from the 13-month tour of duty in Iraq, talk to us about your continuing service here in the States.
So when I got back, Jim, I was a smack dab in the middle of my 4-year active duty requirement. So I was about at year 2, 2.5. So I spent the next couple of years as an active duty officer based out of Fort Riley, Kansas. And I will say that I think that was good for a lot of reasons. Number one, it helped me reintegrate slowly back into the civilian world. Instead of just kind of getting plopped back in after over a year in a war, you know, I was plopped back, but it was still in a military environment for about 2 more years. And that helped slowly integrate back in. And plus, being in Fort Riley, Kansas, a lot of people may not know this, but the duty station is right next to Kansas State University. So I was able to get my graduate degree in finance while I was there, joined the water ski team, and have season tickets to the football game. So I was, you know, slowly able to see what it was like, you know, to be a college / graduate student again. And that really helped a lot.
It still must have been hard to adjust with the fact that 4 of your men died in combat. Was this a single incident or over multiple excursions out into the field?
It was over multiple excursions, which was difficult, and it was over the course of the 13 months. And you know, one of the very, very sad ones was that it was actually my sergeant, the gunner of my tank, was one of the ones that gave the ultimate sacrifice. And he had just left when his wife gave birth to their first child. And, you know, that was just difficult to know that, you know, here was now this child that was going to grow up without a father. And, you know, and I knew his wife, and, you know, she continued to update us, the entire platoon and company, you know, about the progress of her life and the baby and seeing that. And, you know, she was very strong, as was the family that came to support her. But, you know, it was definitely a tough experience to see the realities of what the Iraq War meant to people who served.
Well, I think those who listen to Veterans Radio fully appreciate the sacrifices that your mates made in this instance. And while the general public may not fully appreciate it, John, I want to let you know that you have our deepest condolences. We know a day doesn't go by that you don't think about them.
It is true. It is true. And I do want to make the comment also that I felt incredibly appreciated as a soldier while I was over in Iraq. I mean, the overall support that we got and, you know, everything that we did see was always, you know, even if people didn't necessarily support the war, they always seemed to support the troops. So we really had that vibe, correctly or incorrectly, while we were deployed, which is a really good thing that we had the support of the nation as soldiers. And that was really important. So that was a big thing.
As time moves on and you get to that point of deciding, do you stay in or do you get out, what was going through your mind, particularly as your father, who's a 30-year career officer in the JAG Corps is looking over your shoulder.
You know, to be completely transparent, Jim, I always had the mindset that I was going to be four in and out. And I knew I was going to then serve 4 years in the reserves, which I did. So I served a total of 8 years, four active, four in the reserves. And that was always what I thought I was going to do. I did keep that door open of, you know, if the Army can convince me that it's worth staying active duty, then, you know, I'm not totally closed off to that idea. But I will say in 2006, we were right in the middle of deploying every other year to Iraq. So the decision wasn't too difficult to stay with my initial gut reaction, which honestly was made back in 1998 when I signed up that, hey, I'm doing this for a great ROTC experience to serve my country for at least 4 years. And then in the reserves after that, and, you know, we'll see where my life takes me.
And you picked up your master's in finance along the way. What did you think you were going to do with that?
I thought I was going to get into finance. I did. I thought that was something that was calling my name. And I will say, after only one twist in the road, it actually did. And we can definitely talk about that.
Well, we have to talk about your try. What, one semester of law school, your dad didn't want me to bring it up. And as a lawyer myself, I know how hard that first year is, but most guys don't figure out it's not for them after a semester.
So that was that twist that I was talking about for sure. You know, my father's a lawyer. I come from a family of judges and lawyers, and I really thought that, you know, hey, I love finance, but, you know, I think that this is definitely, or I think this might be the path for me. So, you know, I took the LSAT, applied to law school, got accepted, and I went all in, Jim. I mean, I got accepted to a great school in Rhode Island, Roger Williams Law School, which was right next to my alma mater, Providence College, so I was kind of back reunited with my college buddies. I bought a beautiful place right on the bay, overlooking the ocean. I was in. I was hook, line, and sinker, and then the first day of law school happened, and I just had this weird sinking feeling that I never had before, that I am committing to the wrong path. And, you know, I'm stubborn like most military officers, so I wasn't willing to give in at that point because I had committed a lot of finances, time, and plus my family was really expecting that I was going to be this successful lawyer down the road. So I did stick with it for a full semester, and I busted my hump. I mean, I got done with the first semester with all A's and B's on all the finals, and it was a huge shock to, number one, hand my father my report card and have him see all A's and B's, an A in contracts, Jim, can you imagine? And then to basically, with my other hand, open it up and say, Dad, sit down, I have to talk to you, and tell him in that moment that, you know what, law school is not for me. I'm going to India for 4 months to try and find myself, and I'll stay in touch via email.
And I think it's important that we're going to talk about another little bump in the road before you get to Entrepreneur on Fire, a couple of career changes. But I think it's important, John, for folks to understand life's not necessarily a straight line. And as you transitioned out of the military, you had to try a couple of things, didn't you, before you found what your passion was?
More than a couple things, and 6 years, Jim. Like, it wasn't like, I'm going to try this for a month, try that for a month. Okay, this is me, and now it's off to the races. It was 6 years in multiple failures and false starts, and really both financial and emotional setbacks, you know, before Entrepreneur on Fire came into the picture.
And so you tell us quickly about your stop at John Hancock and your stop in real estate before we get there.
Sure. So, you know, I get back from India. You know, I was trying to find myself out there. I came back knowing that I didn't, but I was in a Bollywood movie while I was out there, which was pretty fun. But I'm like, you know what, now it's time to put this master's degree in finance in order. And I joined a financial firm in Boston called John Hancock, and I was there for about 18 months. And, you know, it was actually a job that when I first started, I was very grateful to have because the economy was starting to go into the tank at that point. And so I felt very blessed to have that job because I wanted something to really sink my teeth into. And I worked my butt off. I mean, I came in there and I immediately rose to the top of my division in the sales department within John Hancock. And I was, again, enjoying it on a lot of levels, but kind of like law school, like I quickly ran out of steam. Like I was sprinting, I like to say, towards success, and I got exhausted. And, you know, I started showing up at that cubicle out of energy, out of steam, no longer being able to be that top sales guy, that person that made the most phone calls, that talked on the phone longer than anybody else. I started, you know, really being like, you know, this isn't for me. I can't see myself being here much longer. So I'll never forget, Jim, and I'll make this quick, but, you know, we had just laid off 70% of our division, and I was really the only person with tenure of under 3 years that was not cut. So I was, you know, I should have been excited that I made this round of cuts that all the financial industry was going through. And the CEO of the company standing up giving the entire John Hancock division a lecture about, you know, how we need to all come together. If we don't want to be here, we need to walk out the door right now because, you know, we owe it to the company to be 100% in. And I had to be honest with myself and say, I'm not 100% in, and I can't pretend like I'm not. So I quit that day of that grand speech by our CEO. I walked into his office with a form letter of resignation. You know, they tried to throw more money at me because they really saw me as being somebody who's going to take one of their divisions to the next level, and it just wasn't for me, and I stuck to my guns, and I walked out with no job and no destination.
Well, Veterans Radio listeners, you can see that when John gets involved, he gets all in, and after this short short message from a sponsor, we're going to get to what he's doing now and what he's all in and fired up on. So we'll be right back.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for 5 decades, so it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
So welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're talking to John Lee Dumas. I'm Jim Fossone. And, John, you've gotten out of the Army. You've tried a number of jobs. It's about 6 years later, and one day the light goes off. You should move from listening to podcasts to actually going into the podcast business. Tell us about Entrepreneur on Fire.
Sure, well, absolutely. So, you know, after that stint in finance, I was in real estate for a number of years, and that involved driving cars a lot. So, you know, there I was stuck in traffic, listening to podcasts as a way to try to inspire myself to actually find something that I was excited about. And I just ran out of podcasts. Like, there was no more podcasts of the types that I liked that were interviewing successful and inspiring entrepreneurs and share their journey. So I did my research, Jim. I went and I searched, and there was no podcast that was coming out 7 days a week interviewing inspiring and successful entrepreneurs. Most of the shows were coming out one day a week, and I knew that was a void that needed to be filled. And I decided to quote Gandhi here, to be that change that I wanted to see in the world. I wanted a 7-day-a-week podcast. I knew other people must want that too. I just had to make the decision to go all in and make it happen because it demanded you going all in because it's a lot of work. So I quit my job that day. Again, I don't hesitate. You know, I don't like to mess around. And I was off to the races. I hired a mentor. I joined a podcast mastermind, and I started my journey of creating a 7-day-a-week podcast. And here we sit, Jim, a couple of years later. Entrepreneur Fire has over 800 episodes published. We've won Best of iTunes Award, and we are consistently generating close to 1 million unique listens every single month.
Well, I'm one of your listeners, and I can vouch for it to our audience. It's a great podcast. Talk a little bit about what your target market is. Who who are you trying to reach, and what message are you trying to instill?
So the audience, Jim, that I'm looking to reach are entrepreneurs, current entrepreneurs, are wantrepreneurs, people who are looking to, like me, break out of that cubicle or that uninspiring job and really take control of their own life, of their own destiny, or small business owners, you know, who have made that leap and are currently running a small business, but they know that they need some tips, tools, tactics that are working right now for other successful entrepreneurs and want to learn more about that. So that's my target market, and, you know, it's an audience, Jim, that's very specific, but at the same time, you know, Entrepreneur Fire gets downloaded every single day in over 145 countries. So it really shows that it struck a nerve, not just with people in the U.S. or North America, but with people who are looking to take control of their lives all over the globe.
John, I know you've spoken to a number of entrepreneurs who have who are veterans, who have military backgrounds like you do. Do you think veterans make good entrepreneurs, and if so, why?
I think veterans make the best entrepreneurs. I might be a little prejudiced, but I truly believe that, and there's a number of reasons. And a couple specific ones that I really want to touch upon are Parkinson's Law and Pareto's Principle, both of which I learned while I was in the military and both of which I've used to apply to my current entrepreneurial journey. Now, Parkinson's Law, Jim, is that tasks will expand to the time that you allot them. So when we were deploying to Iraq, we had 6 months to deploy with a unit that typically would have taken over a year to train, equip, and get ready to go. But hey, we only had 6 months to do it. So guess what? We set up a training schedule. We only allotted half the time to everything that we typically would have. And guess what? We got everything done that needed to get done. So I realized, and I've applied this to my Entrepreneur on Fire career, is that I just allot narrow time frames to work that I have to get done. Your brain clicks into another gear when that happens, and you get stuff done. You know, everybody, we can remember in college when you had to pull that all-nighter. Well, guess what? You somehow got it done. That's Parkinson's Law working for you. And Pareto's Principle is that 20% of your actions result in 80% of your desired outcomes. And that is absolutely a mind-blown for me when I realized that, wow, I can focus on 20% of the activities that result in 80% of my desired outcomes. I can forget about the other 80% that I don't even, you know, that aren't even producing the outcomes that I want anyways, and really focus on what needs to get done. And those are two things that I learned in the military, Jim, that I see a lot of people, a lot of veterans, are able to apply that mentality to their business.
And you've spoken and posted, I think you said 800 or so podcasts at this point. What makes a good podcast?
What makes a good podcast, Jim, is a story that connects with the listener. So I have successful and inspiring entrepreneurs on my show. And one of my big concerns at first was, when I have the Tim Ferriss and the Gary Vaynerchuk and the Seth Godin on my show, are my listeners really going to connect with them and really feel like this advice that they're getting from these successful entrepreneurs is applicable to them? Because there's such a gap, such a chasm there, which is why I make my guests tell a story. And I start with a story of failure, because I want them to know that Tim Ferriss, Gary Vaynerchuk, Seth Godin, that all of my guests have fallen flat on their face, have failed time and time again. And what that does is that makes the listener realize, hey, I connect with that story. If Seth Godin failed multiple times and now he is what he is, you know, maybe that's okay that I've failed before, or maybe it's okay that I'm going to fail in the future. So tell that story to connect with that listener.
John, when you set out to create Entrepreneur on Fire, were you a digital guru at that point? What in the world gave you the idea that you could accomplish this?
I was the opposite of a digital guru. I had no online presence whatsoever, no Twitter account, Facebook fan page. I was starting from ground zero on that. I had no broadcasting experience. I had never interviewed anybody before. I'd never been behind the microphone. But what I did, and this is so critical for any entrepreneur in any part in their journey, I found somebody that was where I wanted to be. I found a successful podcaster who was having the type of success that I wanted for myself. And I reached out to her and I asked her to mentor me. And Jim, it was an investment, and it wasn't cheap. It was thousands of dollars a month, but that investment has obviously proved to be a great return on investment, as in 2014, Entrepreneur on Fire generated over $2.5 million in revenue, over $2 million in net revenue. So investing in yourself is incredibly important.
When you look at the lessons that you got out of the military, John, and you look at the success you're having currently, Do you see more lessons that came out of that that helped you achieve where you're at today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the lessons are endless. And one thing that I really like to stress when people ask me, you know, John, like, who's your mentor now? And I love saying the answer that all 800 plus of the people that I've had on my show have been my mentor in one way, shape, or form. And the relationships that I've built with them, Jim, those have been priceless. And I've learned the pricelessness of relationships, because every single day, Entrepreneur on Fire goes live with a new guest. That guest has a large audience. So when I email my guests with all of the links to share Entrepreneur on Fire with their audience, and I make it easier for them to do so, every single day, my podcast is getting listened to by a brand new audience. So I'm building my audience by adding value to my guests and then being able to leverage their audience every single day. So it always comes back to relationships, Jim. That's the biggest takeaway I can share.
Do you still maintain any relationships with your former Army buddies?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, interestingly enough, I started a company. I'm one of three co-founders of a company called highspeedlowdrag.org, where we, you know, have a weekly podcast where I interview a veteran and we talk about their journey. It's another podcast. And then we also hold webinars every month where we just share things that we've learned. You know, one guy is a Marine, Antonio Centeno. Another guy is an Army captain like myself, Tom. And we are all successful entrepreneurs that are just really spending our time because it is not a basically for-profit situation at this point. We're just doing it because we want to give back to the veteran community. But I really enjoy it.
So give me that again. It was High Speed Low Drag?
Yep, .org, O-R-G.
Well, I think that's a great takeaway for our audience as well to pass along. Either use themselves or pass along to family members who are in the military or working their way out and looking at the civilian world and thinking, well, what do I do and how do I keep the motivation? The drill sergeant helps you get the motivation in the service.
That's exactly what the website is created for. It's tons of free content just on that.
So let's talk a little bit about how folks can find you, John, follow you, connect with you, that sort of thing.
So all the magic, Jim, happens at eofire.com. I obviously own the domain entrepreneuronfire.com, but entrepreneur is kind of a tricky word to spell, so I make it easier with eofire.com. And, you know, for anybody that's just into what you and I are doing, you know, connecting with our voices, I offer a completely free podcasting course for anybody. It's 15 days, 15 video tutorials at freepodcastcourse.com.
Well, John Lee Dumas, I was interested in when I first read the Forbes article on you and what you were doing. I've listened to your podcast, followed you a little bit, and you're a great example of American entrepreneurism, a great example of people who take what they learned in the military and apply it to real life. And I really appreciate you being on the show.
It has been such an honor, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Listeners, we are come to the top of the hour. You know what that means. I want to encourage all of you to check us out and like us on Facebook if you haven't done that. We'll be back next week talking to Dr. Rebecca Grant, and you are dismissed.